Hi there, I'm Sean Eckford, one of the directors here at the Sunshine Coast Festival of the Written Arts, and it's hard to believe that here we are already at Sunday, the final day of Festival 2023. But I'm going to start by doing what I've done the last couple of episodes of our podcast by skipping back a day to catch up on what happened at some of the later presentations after we'd put the podcast to bed. Actually, I'm going to skip back even further than that. I'm going to go all the way back to our opening on Thursday night when we had Adriana Barton and Simon Parody on stage. Adriana Barton has written Wired for Music, a book about how music affects the human brain. You'll remember that. And I talked about the final bit of the presentation between Simon and Adriana, which involved a sing-along, having us all sing to Robbie Robertson's The Wait. And we had a discussion afterwards about what the proper words of the chorus are. Now, as Robbie Robertson wrote it, it's "Take a load off Fanny, you can hum the rest." And, well, there was some debate whether it was actually Annie or even possibly Granny. So I had a chance to catch up with Simon before dinner last night, and he confirms that, yes, Fanny was the word Robbie Robertson wrote in the lyrics, and that was the one he was singing. We still haven't figured out how much of the audience was singing their own different version of that chorus. Okay, let's get back on track with getting back to a couple of the things that happened Saturday that we weren't able to talk about before the podcast was finished. One of them was the presentation by Ted Chamberlain and Teresa Kishkin. It was all about storytelling and how it works and how you can dissect some of it. And of course, that's what we're all about here at the festival. So it was kind of interesting when during the Q&A, one of the audience members asked this question.
As storytellers yourselves, I'd love to know what you think the Brothers Grimm were thinking when they were writing their stories.
I think they were knowing the importance of the tradition that they were part of. I mean, they probably wouldn't have called it a tradition, but those stories were alive, and they were vivid and communicative. They carried lessons. They carried history. They carried important records, moral instructions, and I think they just happened to understand the importance of recording them in the moment, because they were not necessarily the versions of them. They've become the versions of them, I suppose, because they wrote them down, codified them, but many of them went back. I mean, I hear echoes of Odysseus's stories. I hear echoes of stories from all kinds of traditions that were written down much later. I mean, the Odyssey is probably one of my touchstones, and it was probably written about 12 centuries before Christ. We have a version that is probably 800 years before. We don't have Homer's version. We have a version that was written down some years later, and so there were probably many, many versions in between. We have a kind of version now of something that happened hundreds of years before he wrote it down or composed it. So the Grimm brothers, well, I'm grateful for them. Fabulous stories.
it's another good. I mean, lovely thing. I'm talking about storytelling. You're talking about issues, questions that are unanswerable. But I suspect they didn't know what they were about. They were telling a story. I remember going to a concert, a U2 concert, the Joshua Tree concert, way back years ago with my daughter and her friends. And it was extraordinary to me. Something sort of made sense to me. I'd always wondered how it is for me at any rate, that sad songs can make me happy and that lovely music can make me cry. And it does, often. Listening to the drummer first and then Bono opening up to, I still haven't found what I'm looking for. Just took the whole audience in, and they, something about them loved the song in the same way that sad songs can make us happy. I mean, they left about as happy as it's possible for an anguished youngster to get. With all kinds of troubles and problems and things, they were just delighted. And so many of the songs that you two sang were sad songs, were songs of impossible things. And they were wonderful storytellers, and they also knew in the same way that my parents knew when they would tell me a scary song the last thing at night and send me to sleep. They knew something that they couldn't explain. How sort of things are, how dread and delight are closely connected. The sublime and the terrifying, which sublime meaning terrifying, and sublime and the beautiful are closely related as well. So I think they just happened to be extraordinarily good storytellers, going with that instinct that we all recognize about how contradictions work in stories, about those terrible, dreadful things would give delight.
We also heard late Saturday from Tom Rackman, author of several works, but his latest is The Impostors. And Tom is one of several authors we've had over the course of the years who either continues to work at a career in journalism or got their start in journalism. But Tom was the first to express this particular sentiment about why he got into journalism.
My own life and experiences had been far too pleasant to write fiction about. I had the curse of very nice parents and very nice city in Vancouver where I was, and my parents both psychologists, and everything was just disturbingly normal. So I decided that I needed to have some terrible experiences, and therefore went into journalism. The idea was to also, besides having miserable experiences, to see the world, to work on my reading and writing, and just to absorb as much as I could. And I did that.
Now, of course, we can't forget our Rockwood Lecture, which was the closing event Saturday, featuring Jody Wilson-Raybould. Her latest book, True Reconciliation, is now a bestseller, and it really is about how she feels we should be going forward with the important work of reconciliation. And she also mentioned how what's been developing here at the festival's home in Shishel territory is so important to the bigger picture in Canada.
Just look at the landscape here on the Sunshine Coast. I know there are many strong relationships between people that live here and between the nation and all of the communities and governments in this beautiful territory. But I also encourage you to explore the silos that might remain and exist in your stories. To give just one example of one story that I know a little bit about, I encourage you to deepen your sharing and learning about Shishel governance with others, because right here, this place is of vital and distinct importance in the history of this country. It is the first place since the founding of Canada where there was a formal legal recognition by the federal and provincial governments of a model of First Nations self-government. This was in 1986, at a time where the constitutional recognition of title and rights in Section 35 was at its infancy. Almost all the big court decisions had yet to happen, and to be frank, outside of the political world of the failed constitutional conferences to constitutionally protect Aboriginal self-government, there was really very little or no public discussion or understanding of the vitally important issue of self-government. I cannot emphasize to you how important the advancement of self-government is. In my mind, First Nations rebuilding their governments and nations is at the very core of the work of reconciliation.
Life Off the Beaten Track was how we started things on Sunday with Amanda Lewis and Alan Schwartz, authors of Tracking Giants and Galena Bay Odyssey. Now, at one point, Amanda and Alan were asked about which skills they had to work on the most. We'll hear from Ellen first.
I guess I would say the physical work. Because I was so unprepared for it. It was a great surprise to find that I could do it. At that first summer when we were digging the garden plot, and it, like I said, it was solid rocks. Some of them were so big that we had to use a come-along hooked up to the pickup truck to get them out. I mean, they were the size of a chair. It was discouraging. That moment was very discouraging. And I remember, you know, clink. Oh, no, not another one. I can't do this. I can't do this. I want to go home. I don't want to go home, but I can't do this. But I can't give up. I can't wimp out. You know, I can't let down the side. Clink. Oh, no, not another one. That feeling like, will it ever end? I think maybe that.
At the beginning of the book, I included a short list to assess where I was at with my skills. So camping skills, average. Ability to walk long distances, above average. I like doing the pilgrimage routes. Ability to dissect text, excellent. Ability to face down bears, poor. Fear of cougars, healthy. Ability to roll a decent joint, dormant. Superpower, shortening back cover copy. Downfall, anxiety-induced insomnia. Ability to use GPS, resistant. Adherence to the scientific method, non-practicing believer. Ability to parallel park, developing. It's hard to park in a cul-de-sac. I don't know if you've ever noticed that. Ability to identify trees, middling. And the hardest skill, and one that I'm really proud of gaining, is just measuring trees, because it's not something that most of us know how to do, because we usually don't go around measuring trees. And a champion is calculated by a combination of the measurements of its diameter at breast height, which you run a tape around it, measure the circumference, and then pi, you divide by pi, and to get the diameter, and then the height of the tree and the crown spread. And the diameter is pretty easy to figure out once I realize that circumference and diameter are different things, because I failed math a couple of times. And the height was very difficult. There are a few ways to determine height. You can use trigonometry, which I just like, that's not going to be an option for me. Or you can use a laser measure to determine the height. So I borrowed a laser measure from the fine folks in the forestry department at UBC, and that's how I figured out the tree heights. And I need to say, too, that the big tree tracking community was so welcoming and so generous of their time and skills, and really helped me become a big tree tracker, because I didn't even know that was a thing when I set out, that there are big tree trackers. So now I'm better at kind of eyeballing the size of trees, and I'm proud of that skill.
From Contemporary Adventures in the Wild, Janie Chang took us back into history and the craft of writing historical fiction. Janie's latest book, The Porcelain Moon, is set in World War I France and centered around the experiences of Chinese laborers who were working in France on the Allied side. She told the audience that a key to imagining a plot point in historical fiction is to ask, was it possible and was it plausible?
When researching The Porcelain Moon, one of the is it possible and is it plausible plot points, that's a lot of alliteration, is the romance between Camille and Theo. Were there ever such romances? Why, yes. During the war, French women filled labor shortages too, in factories, delivering the mail, running family businesses. In the countryside, they farmed the land since their husbands, brothers, sons had gone to war. And some of these women worked alongside Chinese laborers, and there were sparks. I read accounts of French women who married Chinese workers, and the workers stayed behind after the war, admittedly a tiny minority since most returned home to their families, the families that were the reason they went to France in the first place. One account was about a young woman who said she wanted to marry her Chinese boyfriend because, unlike the Frenchman she knew, he didn't drink, gamble away his wages, or beat women. Kind of a low bar, admittedly, but still. Well, so out of this came the idea for Camille's situation, that of a woman in an abusive marriage. But if there hadn't been such anecdotes, such evidence, interviews with descendants of these mixed-race marriages, I would not have taken the liberty.
It's not hard to imagine some of the real-life characters in Laura Trethewey's The Deepest Map about efforts to chart the seafloor asking themselves, is it possible, about 8 times a day. Laura follows the scientists and adventurers who are trying to reveal a picture of the Earth's deepest places. I was able to grab a few minutes with Laura as she was signing books after her event.
How are you enjoying the festival? I know you've been here for the whole shooting match.
I have. I went to pretty much every single talk that I could go to, and I am so, so impressed with the audiences. They're so warm. They ask really intelligent questions. And the writers who are here, every single talk, like, there's no duds. Every single person is amazing. So, yeah, I'm loving it.
And you've shaken the curse of the pandemic book, so you're...
I know, hey? So my first time I was invited here, 3 years ago, the first book, Imperiled Ocean, came out February 2020, and then I didn't make it here for the next one, so for the next festival. I think the director at the time, she let me do a, I contributed to the journal that was put out, so you guys were continuing to support me, but no, it's a totally different experience to be here. Like, someone's getting me a glass of wine right now. Like, it's amazing. Sad. While I'm
don't do that on Zoom.
Now, I have to ask, because I can't be the only reader who found themselves, like, as well as interested in everything else going on in the book, I got really invested in Cassie's story. And I know that you talk about where she went next in the epilogue, but are you still in touch, and what's she up to?
She actually sent me an email. She currently works as a researcher at the University of Texas in Austin. And after I sent her a copy of the book after it came out, and she sent me an email. And, you know, you see that email pop up in your box, in your inbox, and you're just a little nervous.
Journalist nerves, right?
Totally, yeah. And you see this huge email come up on the screen. And she loved the book. She went through it in a couple hours, read the whole thing, and she thought it was a great read. But she also, just getting her vote of confidence on, like, the accuracy of the science, I really wanted to make sure I represented what her world is like, and she said it was great. So that was literally better than, you know, really anything else I could hear about the book. Like, the person who's the star of the book likes it, that's amazing.
You touched on it very briefly in your talk, but I'm curious about what sense you have as to whether the 2030 deadline for getting a map of the ocean floor done, is that realistic, do you think?
Is it possible?
Now?
Yeah. So CBA 2030 might be upset with me for saying that it's probably not going to happen in time. I hate to let everyone down, thank you. But when I was writing the book, I kept trying to grasp just how much more ocean there was left to map. And it finally became clear to me when I was up in the Arctic Ocean looking at a crowdsourcing project there that, like, we're not even going to finish mapping the Hudson's Bay by the end of 2030. So there's no way that I think we can finish mapping the entire ocean by the end of the decade. So we really need, like, more investment. We need more drones. We need more people to care about finding out what's down there. So maybe it'll be, probably won't be 2030, maybe it'll be 2090. And there's really no penalty if we don't make that deadline. It's really just, you know, we kind of lose out on knowing all the cool things that are down there.
I really appreciate your time, Laura. Thanks so much. Ian and Will Ferguson are well known to festival goers. Their latest joint project is I Only Read Murder, the first in a series of mysteries featuring Miranda Abbott, an actress who once played a mystery-solving pastor. I caught up with Ian and Will on the festival grounds just ahead of their presentation. You know, I'd just like to start off by finding out how your festival experience has been so far. How are you liking it here?
Sean, it's great. This is our third time coming to the Sunshine Coast Festival of the Written Arts. And it's the best. We have such a good time. I would come here just to watch what's going on. It's even better to be invited.
Yeah, I'm enjoying it as well. Last time I came here with my wife and kids, they weren't able to make it this time. But it's always fun to come up the Sunshine Coast. Any excuse to come up here.
Now, this isn't the first time you've written together. And I was thinking to myself, well, my brother and I were both in media for a while. We actually had an informal non-compete clause in our early days. We didn't want to be anywhere near each other. How do you find the experience of writing together?
Oh, it's fun. We look yeah. for projects together. And we wrote How to Be a Canadian together. And I was writing in travel and history, and Ian was writing memoir and more theater. So there was no chance to work together. But we're the opposite. We're always looking for ways to work together.
Yeah, we enjoy working together, and we enjoy making each other laugh. We enjoy spending time together, and the fact that we could come up with a project that we could work together on was great, and it's been fun.
Now, this, though, is meant to be the start of a mystery series, and I don't want you to give away any spoilers, but all I could think in my head is, okay, Conan Doyle, Agatha Christie, Colin Dexter, they all had to kill off their main character to get out of it. Have you thought that far ahead in the arc? Have you said, what happens when we just don't want to do this anymore and we've got to dump her?
That's premature after one book.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a pretty dark
question.
I'm not
sure how your process
is. Are you already sick of your character? No, the second book is done.
Yep.
And the first one is I Only Read Murder. That's out now. And the second one is Mystery in the Title. That's coming out next year. And then we're outlining the third one. So no, we're not sick of Miranda Abbott.
Although, if we ever did want to get rid of her, I assume aliens?
Yes.
Just bring aliens into the book or something? No, of course we're not sick of her. That's very funny.
That would work.
Yeah, just aliens. She just gets abducted by aliens. Huh? Or it was all a dream.
That's a generational reference.
Yeah,
again,
nobody
too.
Gets that, but that's like that. Yeah, no, it's she's a great character to write about. Originally, when we originally had the idea and we were talking, it was going to be a male actor who had once been the star of a show called Pastor Fred, right? And we were sort of still working on the outline. We hadn't written a word, and I called up Will and I thought, what if we flip it? What if we make her an actress? Yeah, and so she was the star of Pastor Fran Investigates, and it's her husband who runs the bookstore. And boy, that just became a lot more interesting to write about.
Yeah, there's something more poignant about a woman who used to be famous crueler. Is more cruel to women,
yeah.
I think.
Yeah.
And originally it was a male actor who used to be famous, doesn't know he's not famous anymore.
Right.
And although it was funny, there wasn't that poignancy,
yeah.
that side of it. And so making it, flipping the husband and wife, really, really helped.
And it's an unfortunate truth in show business that male actors are allowed to age. Female actors, not so much. You know. And I've been I've worked in film and TV and theater and seen all that. So it was fun to flip it. And boy, when you asked if we'd ever get tired of her, I'm not tired of her. I don't imagine.
No,
we love Miranda Abbott.
The other weird piece of headcanon I've created about the process is I always thought, okay, if I were to write a mystery with a co-author, I'd set the mystery and not tell them what it is and feed them clues and make them write the protagonist trying to solve it. I'm assuming you guys went about it in a much more sensible way.
No, it's a classic mystery, so you have to outline it.
Yeah.
We knew who the killer was, we knew who the suspects were, but we did every now and then throw red herrings at each other. I know at one point we had a local sheriff and in the story. So I just added this scene and it said about the case of the missing pocketbook. That there was this woman who lost her pocketbook and then she found the pocketbook. The joke was meant to be small town police work. This was a case he was working on. A woman lost her pocketbook, then she found her pocketbook. And then Ian said, great, what does it mean? What's the clue? And I said, work it out. So he figured out a way to bring what was just basically a joke, like a funny aside, and he made it an integral clue in the actual plot. So we did challenge each other on details, but not on the story.
No, we had. This is meant to be fair play. And what I really like about the reaction we've gotten, the book's been getting a terrific reaction, it's not just that people are responding to the humor, we're both well known for our humor, but that it's a well-constructed mystery. Do you know what I mean? Like when the murderer is revealed, it's fair play and you don't see it coming.
And I think it's easier to write a mystery with a co-author because you can work out problems and you can make it more complex. And sometime a clue that you think is really a solid one, the other one will spot the flaw.
Yeah.
So it actually, I think it's easier to work out a mystery plot with a co-author.
Yeah.
Ellery Queen was famously two people.
Yeah.
So the author Ellery Queen was two cousins who wrote it together.
Yeah.
So that actually naturally leads to the other thing I was curious about is what mysteries do you guys read and which authors kind of influenced you as you were thinking about?
Oh, wow.
I'm
a huge fan of the mystery genre. I mean, Lawrence Bloch, Donald Westlake, Ross Thomas, all those. I mean, I've got complete collections of some of my favorite writers. Agatha Christie, of course, John Dixon Carr, right? You know, yeah. It's a genre I love reading, and it was fun to write a genre that I love reading.
And Ian reads a wider range of mystery. He has a much deep knowledge, and he would explain stuff to me. I mean, when we were setting up the suspects, he goes, you need an obvious suspect, and then you need the clever suspect. So Ian reads a much wider range than I do. I like the classic ones. I like Ellery Queen. I like John Dixon Carr. So I like the older classic puzzle mysteries.
Yeah.
You're avoiding any grotesque violence?
Well, it's cozy, right? We got asked, like, in one interview, like, did you think of writing a thriller? And I was, well, funny thrillers are hard to write.
Yeah.
Elmer Leonard could do it. Donald Westlake could do it. Carl Hyacinth still does it. But a cozy lends itself to humor more. There's one murder. It doesn't, it really sort of happens off stage, literally in this case. It's all about having fun with the characters, enjoying the small town of Happy Rock, all the very eccentric and lovable characters, and also as a reader trying to solve the murder.
It seems, looking in particular at my wife's to-be-read pile, that genre of the mystery, the cozy, seems to be having a real moment.
Oh.
Yeah, very much so. The publisher, HarperCollins, got very excited when we told them what we were working on. It's for whatever confluence of depressing world news and stuff that we've come through, cozies are escape. The thing about a cozy is the world makes sense in a cozy, where it doesn't really make sense in the real world.
And you look at shows like Only Murders in the Building, and it's a real resurgence of that as a desirable bit of art to consume, whether it's a TV show or a movie or a series of books. So we're very pleased.
Great. I really appreciate your time, guys. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Sean. Thanks again.
Well, it's been, as Hawkeye Pierce once said on MASH, a full, rich day. And it's going to get fuller and richer later as we close with music with Tom and Kalissa Landa and their guest, Steve Mitchell. Now, Tom and Kalissa are members of the Vancouver-based Paper Boys. So we'll let them play us out. Thanks for following along this weekend, and remember, you can keep up with festival news via Facebook and at writersfestival.ca.